6 o'clock, and the work session is on the go. So first item is roll call. Mr. Hanselman?
Commissioner Hanselman is here.
Oh. Rolio?
Here.
Bill Brannigan's here. Bob?
Here.
Gary?
Here.
And Mr. Updike?
Here.
And very colorful Dustin is here.
I'm here.
Kind of looks like looks like a Travis Kelsey type show.
Oh yeah, I like it, right? Oh.
Another football question.
Well, okay. First off is the new business. We did the call to order, and the first up is draft of the Affordable Housing CET Code Amendments. Mr. Director.
Thank you. Derek Tokos, Community Development. I'm going to go ahead and put up a screen share here in just a second. All right, share screen. Yeah, well, I'm just bringing up a copy of the code that is in your packet and you had a chance to take a look at.
Okay.
And, you know, you guys the commission briefly had a brief discussion about this at its last meeting. I showed a couple of concepts that I understood you were generally supportive of, therefore I've kind of worked them into code. And if this is something that's workable or close enough at this point, this is not something that has to formally come before you since it's not a land use item, but you can make a motion to move this along to the council so that they know you've seen it and are comfortable with it, assuming that's where you land on it. So there are two changes. The first actually isn't something we'd talked about. I just picked up as part of when I went into the code and saw that this particular provision was confusing. And that's under the exemptions. The exemption, we're in chapter 3.2. This chapter sets out the parameters for how the city applies its affordable housing excise tax. The section I'm looking at right here deals with exemptions. A number of the exemptions are exemptions that are stipulated in statute. They actually stick them under the excise tax provisions that apply to schools, but excise taxes are excise taxes, so they apply to affordable housing excise taxes as well. We deviate a little bit from the statutory one here. We're a little bit more lenient when it comes to affordable housing projects and the benchmark that they have to meet to be exempt from having to pay an affordable housing excise tax. We say that if all of the units are going to be affordable at price points that are at or below 80% of area median income, and they're going to be held there for at least 30 years, that's one way to get the exemption. The other was the convoluted language, which I hopefully have cleaned up a little bit, which says at least half of the units are made available to owner rent to families with incomes of 60% or less of area median income, again, to be held at that price point for at least 30 years. In that case, the other half can be at market. You know, it's harder to hold them at 60% median area income for that same period of time. So that kind of flexibility, saying only half your units is a reasonable way. And I think that's more or less what the language was trying to get at, although the existing language is kind of hard to interpret. So that's the one place that I was going to... There's only two revisions, so this is the first one. Do you have any comments on this one?
Yeah, over the... Well, this doesn't have the 30 years here. It must be somewhere else. But
Yeah, the statute actually talks about 80% or less for 60 years, I believe, is what the statute.
Okay. So we're making it tighter. We're making it harder to be exempt.
We're made a little more lenient because we're only saying 30 years.
But we're saying 60, not 80.
We've got 30, no less than 30 years.
That's the next bullet.
We give them two options.
Am I on the wrong bullet here? I'm on that one.
Affordable housing projects that satisfy the following, A or B and C.
Oh, well, there's the 30 years. Okay. Yeah,
so C says affordability under either of the above metrics is enforceable for a duration of no less than 30 years.
The question is that 60% medium income, as you know, stated, that's revised every year?
Yes.
And so their rent increases are limited to the increase in that number.
Correct. And that's the one that's kicked out. It's a HUD number that's put out by the Oregon Housing Stability Council. So it is adjusted every year.
Eric, on your memo, you talk about affordable housing, meaning housing that is affordable to households with income equal to or higher than 80% of the median.
Well, we're going to get there.
But your proposed ordinance says 80% or less than the area median.
This one right here is dealing with whether or not they have to pay an affordable housing excise tax. What you're referring to, which is the statutory provision that deals with how we can use half of the residential collections, that has to be applied to market rate. That's why that reads as 80% or more.
Yeah, it's weird terminology.
It's weird terminology, but it's the terminology that's in the statutes. You're kind of stuck working with it.
Well, as I read your memo, it almost sounds as though your term of affordable housing could be substituted for market rate housing.
Well, in that context, for how we have to use that 50% of the residential collections, affordable housing is market. In all other contexts, it's not. But in that one, it is. Because that's what the statute says.
Weird language.
All clear? Mm-hmm.
Okay. No.
Thank you.
You got Jim in the clouds with his hand up.
Jim, do you have something?
Well, yeah, I continue to be confused by CET, which I thought was established primarily and maybe solely for use in affordable housing, which was described as 60% or less of the area median income. And now it feels to me that the state is changing the rules and saying it could be as much as up to 80% of the area median income. And even later, we see it can go up to 120. I think that's with condos. But my problem is that the CET and the taxes that we've received thus far were based on an agreement of use for affordable housing. And now it seems that the state is saying, oh, no, we can use it for market rate. And I think that's a really bad step for the state and for the city to take, because we sold it as a tax, and we agreed to it as a planning commission and a city council, that it was solely for affordable housing. So I'm getting a little pushed up against the wall when the state is suggesting we're going to use it now for market rate, and we won't use it all for, only some of it will be used for affordable. That's double talk.
Yeah, let me run through it, Jim. I appreciate that this stuff can get confusing, just the way it's structured in terms of the statute lends itself to confusion. But I'll try to unclarify it as best I can. And so first, let me just kind of run through really quickly again. When we collect an affordable housing excise tax, we are collecting that for residential development, and we're collecting it for commercial slash industrial development. Basically, everything we collect for commercial and industrial development would be used to help with affordable housing, as you understand it, Jim, you know, the less than 60% median area income or less than 80% median area income kind of stuff. So that's the commercial and industrial collections. The residential collections, we have to parse based on the formula they built into it, which is 15% of it we remit to the state, Oregon Housing Community Services, who then drives it back for down payment assistance for affordable housing. That would be your Proud Ground type of down payment assistance grant. That would be a good example of that 15%. Another 35% is flexible, and we can use it for a range of, again, affordable housing pieces. Again, under 60% median area income or under 80% area income. It's only the 50% of the residential collections that we have to make available for development incentives to market rate multifamily, which is also an important part of our portfolio, and who also is paying an affordable housing excise tax as it's a commercial development. And I'm going to show you a slide what those numbers look like. So I think what they were trying to do when they said you had to have development incentives was to take a little bit of the bite out of the upfront cost on the market rate, so that it wasn't such a big difference between upfront costs for affordable housing projects under 60% median or 80% median area income and your market rate projects. And let me show you what that looks like again. Stop sharing this. And let's share this one. You're going to see a slide here. I'm going to zoom it up so you can see the numbers. All right, this is in your packet. I apologize if the numbers are difficult to look at. But what we have two projects here. We have both of which were developed, you know, under a period of time where we've had this excise tax. We put the excise tax in place in 2017. So on the left, you've got the Surfview Village 110 affordable units, 60% median area income or lower. They don't have to pay an affordable housing CET. They don't have to pay a school construction excise tax. They did have to pay SDCs, although they were able to work a deal with the Wilder credit. That's what I was reflecting there. Bottom line, you know, their total cost on this was $250,000, $375,000 if you back out the Wilder credit transfer. You go over and look at the market rate project, which is currently under construction, 78 units. Their upfront cost, because they had to pay the school excise tax and the affordable housing excise tax, in addition to SDCs and your typical building fees, $680,000. And so the change that we're putting in here, which would be, which we didn't get to yet, but which would be to allow that 50% category for development incentives be used for larger multifamily projects to basically wipe out their building fees, that has a meaningful positive effect on those projects. It's not like they're still not paying. In this case, they would have paid $560,000, still substantially more than an affordable housing project. but a little bit less than if that development incentive didn't exist. And I think that's really what that was intended for, so that the market rate projects didn't have to pay full bill, because that's also needed housing.
Derek,
that's my best guess. I mean, that's what they stuck in the statute.
Isn't this the fund that you said hasn't grown as large as you'd anticipated, and it, the impact is going to be relatively modest in terms of what you can do with the funds?
Correct. The overall, we've been monitoring it for about 5 years now, and we're collecting somewhere between $75,000 and $100,000 a year. Depending on, kind of fluctuates, depends on our development traffic. But as you can see, if you allowed a development like this 78-unit one to back out all of its building fees, remember, they're still paying an affordable housing CET. So your actual net drawdown on that's about $37,000 because they're adding to the fund while they're also drawing from the fund, if that makes any sense.
I guess it would depend upon, you know, our fellow commissioners. Where do you put your priorities, on the affordable end or on the market end? Where's the greatest need?
Well, remember, we have the majority of what we collect in the different pots can be used for truly affordable purposes. This small portion by statute has to be used as a market rate incentive.
Is that $122,000? Is that your discretion, or is that required?
No, the way it would be built into the code is we wouldn't have discretion. That would be, if the project was of you know, met the terms, then their building fees would be paid for out of that development incentive pot.
And where is that criteria?
That's in the part of the code we hadn't got to yet.
Okay, you'll point that out.
I'll point that out.
What those parameters are.
Correct.
And then what happens to the developers if we run out of money?
Well, I'm trying to structure this so that it's unlikely that we will, and I think it's unlikely that we will. I mean, look at this example here. I mean, in this case, this market rate project, if you would have had to pay $84,000 to the 50%. I mean, you're adding to the fund while you're pulling from the fund.
You're adding more than you're taking out.
Right, because we treat multifamily as residential for purposes of the affordable housing excise tax. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about that. It's commercial construction, but for purposes of the affordable housing excise tax, it's considered residential development. So half of what that market rate multifamily paid goes into the development incentive fund. So that would have been $84,000 in their case, went into the development incentive fund. And then they draw $122,000 out. You know, so that leaves you, you know, drawing down $37,000. But remember, every single family house pays to it, that's market rate, and they can't draw from that incentive. So that's going to cover that additional 37, I suspect. I don't think this is going to draw that down.
Okay, fair enough.
If anything, it's probably going to incrementally grow and then just take a small hit here and there when we have larger multifamily projects. It feels like a shell game to me in many respects, mm-hmm. but I think it meets the statutory intent for that portion of what we collect. And I'm trying to keep in mind, we have to have a program for that portion. We have all that other that's discretionary that, you know, our policymakers of council, planning commission, you guys can use to actually move the dial on affordable housing, real affordable housing. And we're not talking about the bulk of it right now. We're just talking about this little piece.
Yeah, and to paraphrase one of our colleagues, it's either one of those is more doors.
Mm-hmm.
The market rate or the affordable, and
yeah.
It all helps.
Yeah.
And to paraphrase that same colleague, you don't have affordable without governmental assistance.
Hard.
Hard. I would say it generally doesn't happen at all anymore. Yeah. You know, not real affordable.
No.
It's all subsidized.
Will any of the 78 units be at a reduced rate?
No.
Or are we just helping buy it?
We're just reducing the, basically we're reducing the amount of their upfront cost a little bit. They're still paying an affordable housing excise tax that your actual affordable housing projects don't have to pay at all. So no, the answer is it's all market rate.
Okay, all of the units will be sold or rented at the same rate, except for bedroom sizes, things like that.
Right.
But there won't be any units that are lesser in price like those at the Surf View.
Correct. We're not going down that path.
Okay.
Go ahead,
Is it unusual that the SDC fees for both those projects are so similar? Not knowing anything about how you calculate them.
It's just size, right?
But 110 units is not 78 units.
No, remember, you're talking about one, the rates are different. One project was built in 2019, the other in 2022. The number of units, you know, does play in to a point. Your impervious surface plays in to a point. There actually have been some, because of construction cost increases over the last few years, your SDC fees have gone up quite a bit over the last 3 years. So that's why your 78 unit now is close to that 110 unit back then.
Coincidence.
It's just a coincidence, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So I'm going to go back to the code real quick. I'm going to get down to where we were just talking about. There it is. Now, out of an abundance of caution, I think it was prudent to put some language in here. This is subject to availability of funds. What? Oh, sorry. Stop share. Start share. Okay, so this is the other change, and this is what was pertinent to what we were just talking about. So subject to availability of funds, net construction excise tax revenue from residential improvements shall be used to offset the building permit and plan review fees for multifamily development producing a minimum of 20 units where such units are affordable households with incomes equal to or higher than 80% of area median income. And that last bit is consistent with the statute, which says those development incentives have to be used for the market rate stuff.
So all the units have to be 80% or less, you know, development. Or only 20 of those units have to be.
Well, see, the statute restricts the incentive to those that, either relate to inclusionary zoning, which we're not doing, or the options that increase the number of affordable housing units in a development, decrease the sale or rental price of affordable units, or build affordable housing units that are affordable to households with incomes equal to or lower than 80%. You know, we don't want to really try to tackle B and C because it's an active tracking that we're really not equipped to do. So we're taking the posture, and we talked about this at the previous meeting, that A is the way this makes the most sense for us to administer, you know, with the premise that additional units will necessarily result from development of this scale over time.
Okay, but my question had to do with the size.
Sorry, the size?
Well, it says a minimum of 20 units.
Yeah.
Well, if I had 100 units and I made 20 of them affordable, how does that sort out?
I'm sorry, repeat that bit, Bob?
Yeah, if I was doing a development of 100 units,
okay,
and designated 20 of them as for 80% or, oh.
Greater.
Yeah, wait a minute. This is where it's greater than, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is for market.
So it's almost eliminating the possibility of having any affordable units in that development.
Exactly.
Well, understand, if you have affordable, if you're doing a mixed-use project and you're making some portion of your project affordable, you can parse and set up your project such that the affordable units, you wouldn't pay an affordable housing excise tax on those units. So say you were doing 100 units and you made 20 of them affordable.
Yeah.
We could set that up such that 20 of them would be exempt and the balance of them would not. They'd have to pay an affordable housing excise tax on the balance.
Of those would be affordable at 80% or more of the median income. They'd all be market rate.
The 80% would, but the 20% would not.
So as somebody who's developing and wants to carve out some units as affordable and some units as not, we can work with them on getting the affordable exempt from the excise tax, but the 80% or more would not be exempt from the excise tax, but would be eligible for the development incentive as long as you had more than 20 market rate units.
Okay.
We could find a way to make that work.
Right. Is that done on a per unit ratio, or is it square footage or a combination?
Everything how so far we've talked that? About is on a per unit. Per unit.
Per unit. Okay.
Yeah, everything we've been talking about is per unit.
So it's easy.
Trying to keep it as simple as possible.
Good.
Recognizing that we don't have a large number of these projects.
Right.
So really getting into the weeds about how about, 20 units of affordable with 40 units of market, we may never even see that. At this point, I've yet to see a mixed project. I mean, you see them elsewhere, but at this point, so far, it's been either 100% affordable or 100% market. Because the developer who's coming in like Surfview to do affordable, they're coming in to do everything affordable, and that's the model. But it's possible at some point we see a mix.
Other than another phase at Wilder, is there anything else in the works? And I don't need specifics, but I mean.
Well, we've got Windhaven Phase 3, which they'd like to have. They've discussed it going under construction in 25, which means they'll be coming in maybe even a little bit sooner. They've been talking about getting their building plans in here before too much longer. Interest rates, financing is not very favorable right now for the market rate stuff. And so they've been talking about delaying that project. So we have the 90 units with Windhaven Phase 3 that's getting queued up. And then we have the Wilder, which 20.
Some jurisdictions have like an incentive for market rate housing where they can say like, you'll get X if you can include 10% or 20% of your units at a average medium income of, 60%, but would that, or lower, but would that kick you out of this category if you included that in the market rate?
Well, remember, we do have a multiple use property tax exemption, which is one that can be pursued where you're making a portion of your units. One of the things I'm trying to be sensitive to is our capacity to track things over time and trying to avoid putting our office in a position where we're having to track rates. Whether or not people are maintaining rents at a particular level over 30 years or more, because I just don't believe that we really have the capacity to do that effectively. I mean, that's typically done by, for example, at the state level, you got Oregon Housing Community Services, but that's what they do. They don't do anything other than housing.
How do they do it? I mean, do they like undercover boss style and like try to rent it and find out what they're charging? Because I think about that.
They have staff that are specifically tasked with the reporting end of those projects.
Or the owners. The owners have to report.
Correct. To the state.
Oh, you're saying the city could make that, but you're just saying it'd be an administrative lift to review it every single year. You'd have to.
Yeah, we'd have to have them submit the reports, verify that the rents are at certain price points. Trying to make this a little bit simpler.
Yeah, makes sense.
Just given our staffing.
Is that affordable housing project that Lincoln County Housing was going to do on Canyon Way, is that still floating around somewhere? Is that
nowhere that I'm aware of. That's on the deep freeze at best, is what I understood.
2017 or something. Yeah, it was a while ago.
Yeah, you had worked on it.
Yeah.
But as I recall, the price on that just was too much for the unit, the more units you'd get.
Yeah, it's a tough site. Cool design, though.
Okay.
Beat this up pretty good?
So we make a motion at the regular session to recommend this to the council.
Right.
It just seems the market rate developer is going to pencil it out. They're going to look at the project. What are my upfront costs? What are my construction costs? How long is it going to take me to turn a profit? It seems incongruent to take affordable housing money and help, for want of a better term, subsidize the market rate housing when the need, in my view, is towards the affordable end. And that's the difficulty I have with your proposal, Derek, with all due respect. I'm just suggesting that affordable housing money should help, you know, the folks who can't afford, who have to spend more than 30 or 35% of their take home on housing. And, you know, there's a lot of folks like that here in our community. So this is my liberalist coming out.
Yeah, I guess I'd answer it this way. The bulk of what is collected is available for use for the purpose that you want to. This is a small portion of the overall collections that has to be made available to market rate per the statute. So it's just, how do we make it available?
Doesn't the state take some of it too, right? And then you guys have administrative money out of it?
Well, that's what we were talking about. On the residential collections versus the commercial industrial. Residential, it's 15% to the state, which is then required, which is driven back to us for down payment assistance grants.
Like, it goes to OHCS, or who's it go to, that 15%?
It's required to go to Oregon Housing Community Service, who then keeps it in an account, and then we'll make it available back for down payment assistance here.
So they track where the money came from and make sure it goes back.
Right, because shortly after that CET was put in place, Oregon and Housing Community Services adopted a policy, and they sent that out statewide saying any jurisdiction that puts in place an excise tax and is remitting, you know, that 15% to them, that money would be driven back to those jurisdictions.
It's nothing you can change, but down payment assistance, as you know, is really hard in our community. I mean, didn't Lincoln City and Newport do that a couple of years ago? And like,
we did. We got. Well, I think it was like a total of 8.
How many
countywide? We had 3 in Newport. I think there were 3 in Newport, 3 in Lincoln City, a couple of unincorporated Lincoln County. I think the last one that was done in Newport for down payment assistance was in 2020.
Did it work? I mean, did they sell the house?
Okay, yeah,
cool. That's cool.
I mean, it was in 2020. I think that house was on the market at 340, I think, maybe 320. The subsidy was almost 90,000. I remember that
But for a while, like, wasn't there money available, and you just couldn't find qualified applicants to actually go after it, right?
Well, it took a while for Proud Ground to get some qualified applicants.
Yeah,
you know, in part that lack of familiarity with the program, and then lack of financial suitability. You know.
Has to be viable, yeah, in the long run, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of things that had to be in place. You know, an individual had to be credit worthy. I mean, there's certain things.
It worked,
huh?
It worked. Yeah, I didn't know that. I had heard like all the hiccups that people hadn't applied and they were having trouble finding applicants, or qualified applicants.
Yeah, no, they got there. We had, but what's telling again? That last subsidy was almost $90,000 for one house.
Yeah.
One, you know, home that was purchased.
That was City of Newport money, though, right? Not through OHCS.
Like, oh, that was a combination of funds.
There's city, county, and
yeah,
Lincoln City.
It was the city,
money.
County,
but
Lincoln
it wasn't
City,
state, right?
Oh yeah.
Oh, they did too. Okay.
Yeah, Proud Ground pulled in about $500,000.
Oh, okay.
From the state as part of that pool.
Okay.
So it was a mixture of funds.
So is that like, CET wasn't in place then?
CET was not in place then.
So that wasn't CET money.
No, but think about what you do have is you have a land trust that can leverage those funds in the future.
Yeah.
So there'll be another round at some point, probably modest, maybe 5 to 10 homes. And what your subsidy now is probably going to be 120,000 to 150,000 or more.
Help keep up with inflation.
It's going to be. I mean, that's the tough thing with the down payment assistance right now.
Yeah. One last comment on this screenshot that you have, Derek.
Yeah.
And I kind of echo Braulio's comments. This is a pretty big hole. With this last line, when incomes could be equal to or higher than 80% of the area median income. So according to that rule, a project could be built and the affordability, I hate that word at this point, the affordability, they could put it all the way up to 140 or 160% of the area's median income. And they would still qualify for help if they put 20 of their units at something less, or at 20 of them equal to greater than 80%. So anything above 80%, they would still get support from the CET. That's equal to or higher. That's ridiculous.
That's what the statute says. We don't have flexibility in that regard. But I'm going to go back to the slide because I think it's really important to keep in mind that the projects that are getting this benefit,
yeah,
all we're doing is reducing basically that cost somewhat. It's not like, I mean, they're paying a whole bunch of affordable housing excise tax for those market rate units. So I'm going to bring up the share here again.
Yes, but their market rates can be anything above 80% of the median family income or median area income. So they could build it at any price they want to if they think they can rent them or sell them.
It's just a math equation that's hard, though, because what's our average median income? Isn't it like 25 grand or something?
Yeah, well, these
50,000 is the current number.
That's a household, though, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, households over 50. I think, I thought individuals like 25,000.
Yeah, right now, I mean, this Windhaven project, this 78-unit project, and it's got a mix of units, mostly one and two bedrooms. I believe they have, they're currently, they had them advertised, and I want to say they were between 14 and almost 2,000 a month, depending on, for the three bedrooms. I think you were up in that 19 to 2,000 a month. I mean, that's what your market rate is. But again, this project paid almost $170,000 of affordable housing excise tax. Yeah, they're getting a benefit under the building fees of $122,000, but they're still paying an excise tax. So that didn't offset even the excise tax, full excise tax. It bought down some of their upfront cost, which can be meaningful as to whether or not that project happens or not.
But it didn't increase the number of units.
Well, if the project moves forward, we get 78 units. If a project has too much upfront cost, can't pencil out, we get 0 units.
But the statute you quoted said it would increase the number of affordable units in development. So it would seem to me the fund should then push the number of units from 78 to 80 or 84 or something like that.
I think, like I said in my memo, I think the tact we're taking here is that by doing this programmatically for projects of that, at that scale, you will necessarily get more units than had you not provided the incentive and just try to take that tact. Really, our focus should be on how we use the balance of the funds to actually move the dial on affordable housing. This is that small piece we have to use for this kind of purpose. We don't have a whole lot of flexibility here, as I pointed out in the memo. This is spelled out in statute in terms of exactly what type of incentive it has to be.
Well, I understand our plight, Derek, but I can see that at the state level, this clearly wasn't as well thought out as the legislature will say it is, because we've already been able to pick this thing apart and show it doesn't create any more affordable housing, but it is what we're stuck with. I understand that.
Yeah, my suspicion is that the legislature, the way that with the develop, you know, you always have home builders at the table there. And my suspicion is what they said is if you're going to hit us with an affordable housing excise tax, we want some form of development incentive for our market rate stuff. I mean, that's pretty much probably I'm what sure the conversation was.
Yeah, lobbied very, very hard.
Yeah, and so that was the compromise. And again, it only applies to a portion of the collections. Half of the residential collections gets hooked in this manner. None of the commercial or industrial collections get hooked at all. And the other half of the residential collections we have flexibility with as well, for the most part. So it's one of those things where it's, okay, we live with the compromise. But we have to have some way of doling this out. We can't just keep accruing it and not making that incentive available.
Is it staff-level decision on the qualifier, that first part of, like, as funds are available?
Well, yeah, that's just, you know, if the fund was exhausted. But the way this plays out, the way I'm looking at it, I think that's unlikely.
You know, I mean, I'm trying to think.
Because these projects, like the 78-unit market rate one, are replenishing that development incentive at the same time they're pulling out of it. So that's why I was showing that example. You can't see it very much, but it's in your packet. But that down in the corner here, I mean, this project paid, well, sorry about that, it paid $84,000 to that 50% category, and it pulls $120,000 out.
Oh.
So that's a modest drawdown. It strikes me that's likely sustainable considering, you know, we have probably at most 50%, somewhere between 40 and 50% of our construction would be in the multifamily range. And not all of that would be over 20 units. So a lot of
Derek, do you believe that market rate construction won't occur without the states pressuring us to use these funds for their market rate housing?
I think this helps. Will it not? No, we're still going to see it. There are a lot of factors that play in here, some of which we control, a lot of which we don't control. Availability of land, current financing, you know, conditions. You know, there are a lot of other things that drive whether or not these projects happen.
Financing right now, I don't think lends itself to development and market rate at all.
No, but, you know, you have projects, too, that are unique. Like Windhaven, they don't have really the land costs because those properties have been held for decades by the same entity, you know. And so, you know, everybody's a little bit different. So, yeah, there's going to be market rate that happens, but it helps. We certainly could get ourselves, in, especially, you know, we'll have to continue to make adjustments, but we do need to be sensitive to upfront development costs. They can be a barrier at times. And this is one way of knocking it down a little bit for those projects.
You know, you suggested option A because option B was, given the size of our staff here,
yeah,
it would be burdensome to administer.
Right.
Did you give thought to option C of maybe subsidizing some folks in a market rate, folks who might otherwise not be able to afford a market rate housing, subsidize their part of their rent for 2 years or so, use the same 20 in that way? Was that given any thought?
Well, B and C, I did put some thought to the other two, and in both cases, you know, from my perspective, we're looking at tracking that we would have a difficult time trying to implement. And again, we've got a lot more. The bulk of that fund is not hooked in this manner. The bulk of the affordable housing excise tax monies are going to be available for a much broader range of things that our policymakers may want to do. So,
okay, I think we've exhausted the conversation. So in the remaining 15 minutes, move on to item 2B, establishing a creative work light industrial use category.
All right.
Emails from Janet Webster and Carol Schenk.
Yep. Let me bring that code draft up and touch on there, and I see Carol's here, so. This is pretty close. I think there are only a couple of comments that Carol and Janet had that I think would lead to potential changes, and they're pretty targeted. The whole thing is actually fairly targeted. But I'll go ahead and bring up the code. So back in September, they'd presented the concept, and that was something that you as a commission felt would be appropriate, and you wanted to see some code language, and I put some code language together. I'm going to zoom this up so you can read it on the big screen. So the ask was to create a new kind of industrial use category for small-scale custom craft-type activities where people were engaged in either custom or handmade types of manufacturing that didn't require assembly line-type setups and things of that nature, so small-scale stuff. That didn't necessarily have that wasn't just being manufactured for sale retail on the premise. Because if it's being manufactured for sale on the premises, it was already authorized as a retail use under the code. So this is more of the, maybe they're not selling on the premises, but they're selling Etsy or, you know, whatever, you know, and it's most of it's being shipped and they don't have a real retail presence. So as you're familiar with our all of our commercial codes, we have these commercial use categories, and the use categories, define or describe the characteristics of the use and provide some examples. The examples are not intended to be exhaustive, but just to give you a sense of what types of use fall under the characteristics of that particular grouping. And early in the code, it talks about how the community development director is responsible for figuring out, you know, which category a use falls in. And if it's not clear, then we can go through a type one land use process to sort it out. So I plugged it in under manufacturing, because that's kind of where it fits. Expands that to three subgroups instead of two: custom, creative work, small scale, light manufacturing uses that are made to order or which involve considerable handwork as part of the production process. Such uses are produced without the need for a mechanized assembly line and are wholly contained within a structure such that they can be located within commercial zones and near residential areas without creating nuisance impacts. So that largely borrows from the Seattle example that they provided. The Seattle example placed emphasis on the made-to-order or considerable handwork and lack of a mechanized assembly line. As really kind of being the key defining characteristics of custom creative work versus your typical light industrial work. Then uses include artwork, sculptures, candle making, pottery, ceramic tile making, so on and so forth. This combination of the Seattle and the list that Carol provided. I believe she mentioned that food processing or beverage processing would be something she'd like to see listed. That's fine. It fits within this category as long as, you know, there's not an assembly line piece, so it's not rogue brewery, you know.
Well, small batch brewing.
Well, there's small batch canning and brewing is in here. I thought she had something in her email, and she'll have a chance to speak to you guys. But my point is, this is just a list of examples. If there's a couple other examples that make sense, that's fine. It's a list of examples.
Well, the way this reads, those are the only uses.
Mm-mm.
Says uses include.
Says include, but as was included, I don't have it in this draft code, but it was in the email that you have a copy of, and that that I shared with Janet. Above this, it talks about these just being examples that it is my responsibility to identify, you know, based on the characteristics and list of examples where a particular use fits. So,
well, okay. This is the code.
Well, correct.
Instead of uses include, maybe that should say examples include.
If we make these changes, that then I got to go change every single industrial, every characteristic in that entire code so it's consistent. This is how it's consistent throughout. If we go in there and start saying includes but not limited to or every examples, I got to make every single one of those changes, and I don't know that it's additive to anything because the code is pretty darn clear that, you know, these are examples. That they are not the end-all be-all.
Where, just point out where it's clear. When we have the
it's
code
in the
here.
Email response I provided to Janet.
Did you get a copy of that?
It's one of the emails that Sherry forwarded to you. I'm digging it up in the packet right now.
While you're working on that.
Here we go.
Is it important that we identify nuisance impacts?
Nuisance impacts are covered under nuisance code. They're explicitly spelled out in the nuisance code, separate section of the municipal code. So application of use categories is sub A under 060. By the way, you're looking at sub D. So what the amendments are further down in the code. But if you were looking at sub A, it says application of use categories. Uses are to be assigned to the category whose characteristics most closely describe the nature of the primary use. Developments may have more than one primary use. Use examples are provided for each use category. The names of the uses of the lists are generic. They are based on common meaning of the terms and not on what a specific use may call itself. For example, a use whose business name's wholesale liquidation that sells mostly to consumers would be included in the retail sale and service category rather than wholesale sales category. This is because the actual activity on the site matches the description on the retail sale and service category. Interpretation: when a use's category is not clearly identifiable, the community development director shall determine the applicable use category under a type 1 decision-making process, and then it goes on to spell out, you know, the factors to be considered as part of a type 1. So this is how the whole thing is structured.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. With that language,
yeah,
it clarifies it. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. So that's the list. And then the next change is to the chart, which adds custom creative work in there. So now this is the only industrial use that's allowed in our C2, for example, because light industrial currently by itself is not allowed unless, like I mentioned, it was being sold on the premises. If it was being sold on the premises and that was their primary front end, then that's permissible. We have taffy shops on the bayfront. That's how they're permissible. They're manufacturing for the purpose of sale on site. That's already allowed under the code. This amendment is targeted at, say, that taffy operation that doesn't have a retail front end. It's small scale, handmade batches, and they sell them online or whatever. And they don't really have a retail presence. This picks that piece up.
Brannigan, we have a guest. Does she have any comments on this?
I'm almost done going through what the amendments are real quick, and then I'll be finished. But so there is a provision that I put in here limited to a maximum of 2,000 square feet of gross floor area. That can be adjusted as well, or you don't need to even have a cap if you don't want it. I would suggest one.
In the C2, if it's over 2,000 square feet, that takes it out of any use in the C2, not just what this amendment, any use in the C2 under existing rules over 2,000 square feet triggers conditional use. That's existing code. It was intended to get at larger commercial development. Much of our C2, as you know, is within the Nybeach Historic Design Review Overlay. So, you know, that overlay really is intended to minimize mass as much as possible. And so that's kind of where that came from. If you look at descriptions of this, of small, you know, craft type industrial uses, I included a couple example links in here to sites that kind of drill into this. They typically say it's no more than 5,000 square feet in size, and most are in the 1,000 to 2,000 square feet in size. So I think there's some play there. I probably wouldn't go over 5,000 square feet. If you do, what that means is anything between 2 and 5, at least in the C2, would be subject to a conditional use review. Whereas if it's under 2,000 square feet, fine.
What's any idea what the average storefront size is in Nybeach?
Oh, it varies. Because larger ones are broken up with tenant space. Right. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
That building where the new real estate guy moved in, the one we approved last year.
Oh, that's going to be under 2,000 square feet.
Going to be under?
That tenant space. Certainly the building is quite a bit bigger. But space isn't going to be that big.
I have trouble visualizing it, so okay. But the marijuana place, that's over 2,000, isn't it?
Typically, your bigger ones tend to be your restaurants. The ones that I think of down there, your retail, a lot of your retail is relatively small. I'm thinking like 222, you know, places like that are relatively small. But some of your restaurants, like Tap House, is quite a bit bigger than 2,000.
Okay.
Is the marijuana shop in Nybeach?
No, I'm talking about the marijuana manufacturing facility.
Oh, okay.
Over there where Facets used to be, right in there.
Really? It's a grow operation?
It's not a grow. I think it's a processing. And then there,
grow too.
You mean the one there on the back end of the turnaround? I thought
not in the turnaround at all. It might not even be in Nybeach.
Are you talking about the one up on Grove? The only processing one that I can think of was
next to they're next door or in the building where Facets used to be.
It's Facets. I'm trying to remember
the gem shop.
You got me on that one, Bob. I'm not placing the location.
Oh. Near the bakery, bread bakery.
No,
Panini?
No, you're talking about up by, what is it, Travelodge and up in that area? Up by
the hamburger place.
The hamburger place, fast.
And then in the back, there's the. There's the.
On the back side of 101. There's
the bread outlet store in the back.
France
outlet. Bakery, up by the France Bakery outlet?
Yeah.
That's the grow. That was a.
It wasn't a grow. It was a processing.
Processing. It was processing.
Yeah.
They had plants that they're drying leaves, all that kind of stuff. I remember that. Yeah, and they had the whole ventilation issue.
Yeah. All right. Whatever. I have no problem with the 2,000, I guess, so I can't visualize it anyway.
You could. There are a lot of different places to go. I think the bigger you go, I think that's why it should be relatively small, because if you get over 5 and you're getting closer, you're getting fairly large, and then you're starting to get into uses that are less human scale for ped walking up and checking out what's going on, which, you know, in these tourist commercial areas, you got a lot more human scale activity, people walking, biking. You know, looking at storefronts, you get very large, and those types of operations really are looking more for light industrial. That's more of a shipping orientation, storage, warehousing kind of orientation.
Okay, we do have a guest, Ms. Schenk. Do you have anything you'd like to say, or you're
Thanks to Derek for your work, and we support these changes. I think the wording confused me also about the including but not limited to, and so I think replacing the canning and brewing with food and beverage production would be more generic, and then the specific processes of can maybe make sure that those terms are generic enough that people can imagine what they might be able to do, because to me a function of the code is not just the legal interpretation, but also people look at it when they're imagining what they might do with a property, and if it's unclear, then that might deter somebody who would legally be able to make a change. And then the 2,000 square foot seems to make sense, and Derek clarified that that's applying to the use and not the building. So thank you.
Could everything gets recorded. So could you give us your name and address?
Oh, I apologize. Yeah. Carol Shank, 437 Southwest 5th Street in Newport.
Okay, thank you. Rolio has a...
Are you with the Coastal Arts Guild?
Correct. I'm the vice chair of the Coastal Arts Guild.
I think it's always enlightening when, you know, the community or the public says, hey, we see this need. And could you maybe help us understand why there is this need in our community now?
We have, we know individuals who have considered purchasing property or specifically purchasing property in Newport that were deterred by the current zoning, either because of the use would be prohibited outright, or you can't get a commercial loan based on a conditional use possibility. So our mission is to support the arts in the community, and this seemed like a place that would allow the city to support a more flexible development, and also with urban renewal about to be undertaken, it seems like it would be helpful to have this foundation of a clear intent to allow this kind of use.
Sense.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we've exhausted that. It's now 7 o'clock, time for the regular meeting. However, we do not have any...
Didn't you have one other item?
Public here.
Yeah, I do have one other item, if that's all right.
So we do have 2C, the commercial to residential conversions. Mr. Director.
Yeah, I'm trying to... Thanks. So just to close off that last one, I'm more than happy to make the clarification that Carol requested in the examples, so that there's some additional language in the examples. So if at the regular session you want to move that forward with that, perfect. The last item I had on the work session was House Bill 2984, commercial to residential conversions. And so I'm going to be talking to the city council about this. That bill has language in it that says you can't apply system development charges you can only apply system development charges to conversion of a commercial building for residential use if you have an affirmative policy that's your intent. And you have to have that affirmative policy in place by the end of this calendar year, which is rapidly approaching. Now, we don't exempt uses from SDCs. If you have an additional impact on the system, you pay the fee for that additional impact on the system. Where we have residential conversion of commercial space, in many cases you don't have an additional impact because you're occupying an existing building. Your impact on your water and wastewater system may not be any more than what the commercial impact had.
transportation may be a wash, your impervious surface isn't any greater in those cases, you don't have an STC payable because you don't have an additional impact. Other conversion of commercial space to residential use, say it's a warehouse or a open office space, and you're putting in a bunch of additional residential units, well, then maybe your traffic impact is greater, for example, or your water and wastewater impact is greater, or you're adding on to the commercial building in addition to just the conversion. So now you have a bigger footprint and more impervious surface. Additional impact, you pay for the additional impact. My recommendation to the council is going to be that we put in place a resolution that say, yes, we intend to apply SDCs uniformly per our code, which includes the conversion of commercial to residential use. And if there's an additional impact under that methodology, then an SDC is payable. If there isn't, then it's not. Otherwise, you know, if we don't and we start getting more and more of those bills, then it's just like trying to figure out, you know, okay, which, you know, how do, where can we apply SDCs and we're not being preempted by some legislative bill for a particular special interest.
Similar like parking credits, right? You get parking credits when you, based on what an old use is. If if you take a restaurant that has a huge demand and turn it into residential, then you wouldn't pay anything.
Right.
And look, yeah, it makes
similar principle.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Do, if that's the case, there's no additional impact. And if there's a lower impact, what happens to the excess SDCs? Are those transferable to somebody else?
Well, good. Good question. Current, no, they are not. They would still be available. The credits go away if not utilized within 10 years under the code.
But they can't transfer them like Wilder did. Was that a one-time thing?
Well, Wilder's had to do with qualified public improvements, so it's how they got the credit that's different. So in their case, they got the credit because they oversized water and wastewater mains and constructed a collector roadway instead of a local, which is what they would have been typically required to. Those they could transfer.
Those still,
but just credits by virtue of what you assume when you buy a property is different type of credit.
Okay.
Those still have an expiration, right? I mean, that's why Bonnie...
By statute, 10 years, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why we put the credit provision in for qualified public improvements. Yeah. 10 years probably works well in a metro area where you've got a lot more demand. It's tough in our area, a more rural area, where you're not generating enough development to utilize all of the credits within the 10-year time frame. But I did want to share this with you in case you had a... interest in chiming in at all, or you don't have to, but that's, I want to make you aware of it, and that's our plan.
It seems like the right thing to do.
Is it fair to say this is more a just an administrative issue for you all versus a fiscal impact issue? It really isn't much of one, right?
Yeah, I think it's more of a tripwire issue for us than anything else, and it's a principal issue. If you have an additional impact, you got to pay the fee. Just because you're a residential going into a commercial area doesn't make you special. Because it's not fair then to the others that are paying SDCs for the impact that they're having.
Yeah.
You know, so the whole premise behind SDCs, the SDC statutes as they're currently written, and you had a lot of interests weighing in was, and one of the big ones was, make sure that everybody is treated equitably. It needs to be based on a methodology, you know, that, you know, is applied uniformly. Not that certain interests get more favorable treatment than others by some arbitrary means. These types of odd carve-outs create those kind of arbitrary circumstances.
Restaurants were that way, right?
But you're right. Fiscal impact on this is negligible. Most of those projects are going to be largely credited out anyway. If they have to pay an additional fee, it's not going to be a barrier to development. It's usually on those, it's something like maybe it's $10,000 or $20,000. On a larger project, that's not that much.
It'd be nice to find a way to incentivize some of that conversion and get some more housing.
But that's a different topic.
One of the big challenges, frankly, and the reason we don't see as much of that is because of the age of the commercial buildings we have. And they're just really physically not in a condition where they can be converted. I mean, it's really more of a demo and rebuild. And you, because old unreinforced masonry in the city center area, you can't do it. I've had a number of people say, oh, it'd be wonderful if I would like to put apartments up here on the upper level. And then they actually get in and look at what they're dealing with structurally, and it's like, this is a way to make this pencil out.
When you have a use change like that, too, you have to update. When you have a use change like that, everything has to be updated. So you have to add a sprinkler system. You have to have firewalls between the different units. You have to have ADA accessibility. Anytime you're changing use like that, it's basically they look at it like a brand new building. There's nothing, you know, grandfathered in. It's just all new.
Right, and a lot of those, I mean, the other way you try to get a pencil out is to get additional units. Well, that means additional floors, and they just can't bear it. I mean, they're just not designed such that they can take on the additional load.
Yeah, we have to be the bearer of bad news with that request a lot, where people want to add or convert, and it's not economical in most cases.
Okay.
So the work session is officially ended.
Have a lovely evening.
All right. See you later.
Hey, when's your church going to be done?
Doors.
By the end of the year?
No. Not even close.
Step by step.
Your buddy.